Wow, guys, what's up? You guys need to come to the awesome stream that we're going to do on time on April 10th. It's going to be amazing. There's going to be Dan, Mr. Mouton, other exciting and fun political guests, because we're going to be doing a fundraiser for a digital ground game. There's going to be minimal ARC Raiders, maximum politics and political engagement. We're going to be fundraising for canvassing houses and races and just all sorts of amazing and cool things. So make sure to show up. Also, look at this sick shirt that we're going to be selling as well. Oh, my God. What does it say? It says Iberia. Oh, it says liberals. It was covered up a little bit. Liberalism. How cool is that?
Okay. Before we dig into this, is there anything? Well, first, I guess I'll introduce you a man who needs no introduction to my audience, because we watch a lot of your content on my stream. Tim Miller from The Bulwark, ex-Republican, I think, into never Trump Republican now, into, I don't know, where you consider yourself necessarily. I know the never Trump Republican people are kind of in a weird spot where they're not quite liberal, but it's hard to be conservative. And yeah,
I embraced it for, I'm a functional Democrat, I guess. I embraced it when I did Jubilee. The producers there wanted to call me a millennial liberal, and we argued about it a little bit. And I was like, I mean, in the classic sense, I'm a liberal. And so if you want to be pedantic about it, we can do that. And you know, it felt good on me, you know, putting on the liberal shirt. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's nice. Progressive, I don't know if I could do, but yeah. The liberal button, I'll put on the liberal button.
Okay. I have, is there anything in particular that you wanted to chat about or anything? Or, because I've got like a whole, a
no,
couple
man,
things.
Let's just do whatever you want to chat about. It's funny, I've been wanting to do this. We went back and forth a little bit, and like I eventually said I was going to do it like before the discourse, the Hassan discourse, the streamer discourse all started. So I'm sure some people didn't hear about that. But I want to talk about whatever you want to, man. I'm just, I was like, if I'm going to dive in and do streaming myself, I might as well, you know, get out there. So whatever you want to do, I'm game.
Okay, cool. So for some of these things, I have this conversation in my mind broken out into three kind of parts. So the first thing I want to talk about is kind of the conservative media ecosystem. The second thing is like platforming in general. And then the third thing is, in my opinion, I would argue that people like Hassan and socialists in general should be totally cut from like any kind of liberal Democratic Party movement thing. And then, yeah, I think these kind of build into each other. So on this first topic, one thing I noticed when I hopped into media coverage or political coverage or whatever in 2016, I came at this from a very online perspective. And it's kind of weird because I feel like I had to learn more real world politics and media, but I feel like we've kind of curved back into now everything is just online. Like in 2016 and 2017, especially if you were like a Bernie supporter or, you know, part of the more like kind of progressive movement, the sayings were always like, you know, Twitter is not real life. And right. It definitely seems like it definitely is now in a lot of ways.
How did you get into it? When did you start popping off on the 2016 campaign?
Kind of. There was this horrible movement called Gamergate.
Gamergate.
Kind of. And then I was like, I'm kind of like a more aggressive style person, but I was like on the left in terms of social issues. So it was easy for me to get into conversations because back then the reputation was only conservatives can debate people. And then I was able to do that. So I grew up.
My view on all that is, look, I think you have to understand online to understand what's happening. And I think that there are some Democratic politicians in particular who are still kind of like unfrozen cavemen and like don't engage, you know, even if they're not like posting themselves, I think all politicians would be posting themselves, like they're not even like consuming the conversation online. And I think not understanding that is pretty limiting in this day and age, at least about how to get your message out. Mm-hmm. I think that like you can overlearn the lesson. Like you can still be too online. There are ways in which it's not real life, you know. And I think that we saw the Trump people be too online in ways that have hurt them recently. You see this sometimes with Democratic politicians too. You know, because like just for example, like the most vocal voices online are not necessarily representative of the mean, right? Mm-hmm. And I see this all the time. Like when on the Bulwark, like if I will say something that will piss off the left or the left part of our audience, the more progressive side of our audience, and like the comments will be very like critical of me or whatever it is, like on this same or how about just putting it this way, even if it's not on a topic, like let's say I have a guest on, like I had Joe Manchin on or Jake Tapper or somebody who's like out of vogue with the online left, like the comments will be very negative, but like my texts and emails will be very positive. You know what I mean? And like the numbers will show that like just as many people engaged with it or whatever. And so I do think like that that's like you can overlearn what is happening online and like overinterpret it as being representative of everybody. But, you know, so that's a risk. But I think that like going the other way is such a huge mistake. And we saw this with Biden. You see this with Democratic candidates all the time, where if you're just, if you're not involved in the discourse, then you can't control it. You know, I mean, Trump, say what you want about Trump, like Trump knows how to control the discourse and the narrative. I might be getting away from him a little bit right this second, but for the most part, he's shown a, you know, an adept ability to do it. And that's part of that is that he like posts.
Yes. Okay. So my goal in this conversation is to impart an idea I have on you, or to get pushback and tell me why I'm wrong, so it can so I can change the way that I view this. Okay, so one of the frustrating things that I'm kind of noticing when people are analyzing Donald Trump, or when people are analyzing conservative messaging or Democratic messaging, is I feel like there is this pipeline that is moving in the background that seems to go unnoticed, or people like see it but they don't realize its impacts. But then we spend so much time analyzing what sits at like the end of the pipeline without realizing that at that point it doesn't matter. What mattered was the whole thing kind of like leading through the pipe, and then whatever anything can be produced at the end, but it doesn't matter. So when I'm looking at like the conservative media ecosystem, okay, I'm looking at like three kind of prongs for this. So there's this ideological component that is constantly maintained with think tanks like the Heritage Foundation or the Federalist Society. And even in off years, even when Republicans appear to be totally absent from the discourse, there's no president, whatever else, they're always working on stuff in the background, right? Whether it's Project 2025, whether it's this back and forth with people in DC or whatever. Then you have your media arm, which is on the conservative side. It is a, it is functionally, and it, in practice, it really is like a messaging arm for the Republican Party. Where their job is to do PR for the Republicans. That's it. That starts and stops there, right? When you have these two things working in lockstep, where the you've got your ideological foundation that can generate ideas or whatever else, you can get political figures that come up, and then when these political figures go onto their media platforms, and then basically what they do here is they just do messaging for their whatever they're campaigning for or with the administration or whatever else. Once you have this like stuff created, when the alternative media world gets to consuming that, because so much of it has been made palatable on like Fox News, and there's no discontinuity between any of the messaging, the alternative media can pick up a very coherent and consistent message, and you have this huge feedback loop that's going from top to bottom that makes it so that literally any message you want can be sold in this way. That it's not necessarily that like Trump, like there are going to be things that can make things better or worse, right? Selling Trump doing something goofy is going to be easier than selling DeSantis doing something goofy. But I think if you take a step back and you look at like some of the things that people can get away with on the Republican Party, I think it's impossible to explain it with just, well, they're good at messaging, or it's because this guy is affable or whatever else. It's because when they start at the top, Trump will say a goofy thing. He goes on to Fox News. He's never getting a critical interview. They're massaging and helping the PR as much as possible. And because it's so consistent, when alternative media picks it up, the audience is already there and hungry for it. They're going to do the same thing back and forth. And sometimes those same administrative figures will go onto these shows, that all of that ecosystem will make any message palatable. And that that thing exists in two places. It exists on the, I would say, the far right, which is MAGA, which is the entire legislative body of the Conservative Party. And then I would say that it exists on the far left, which is unfortunate because that represents 2% of the Democratic Party and none of the lawmakers.
Right. A lot there, and I think that there's some parts of that I agree with for sure. I think that I think we should set aside. I think the area that I might disagree with is the ideological and policy side. I think so. I think we should just put that into a bucket to talk about at the end, because I think you know, there are a lot of fractures on the right on that that are sort of that have been frosted over by the cult, right? And like that's why it works for Trump and didn't work for DeSantis in a lot of ways, that like Trump has this cult backing him. So anyway, we'll come back to that. I do think that just like the cohesiveness when it comes to negative messaging on the Democrats, for example, and negative message on crazy things that happen on the left, is a absolute superpower. And it's a cohesiveness that goes from the top, from Trump himself to the other Republican politicians, to Fox, to into their alternative media. You can see it immediately. They can elevate something that's kind of a stupid non-story into getting it to such a level that like alternative media has to talk about it, liberal media talks about it. I find myself like trying to fight this off as much as possible, like not commentating on the on the crazy, but that's hard. And so I think they're really skilled at that, like the negative messaging. I think that pipeline that you're talking about, it works basically like without any, you know, any issues when it comes to the negative messaging. Uh-huh. And I think that this hurts like the Democratic Party brand, because that other group's pipeline that you're talking about, like that, they amplify it, right? Like yeah. The far left's also attacks kind of the main body of the Democratic Party a lot of times, and highlights the ways in which they're crazy or maybe just out of touch, or sometimes it's not even true, with voters. And so, you know, kind of the main body of the Democratic Party does have it coming from both ways with two pretty efficient communications pipelines. So I think that part of it I agree with. You're talking about the Heritage Foundation, the Project 2025 stuff. I don't know, man. I think as we look ahead to 2028, if Trump really does go away, we're gonna see huge infighting over policy stuff.
I definitely agree that
they do not have any cohesive actual view, and like the Trump cult of it allowed them to kind of, hey, we'll put out these policy things behind the scenes, and as long as Trump blesses it, then everybody will be for it. Even people who used to would have been against it. You see that with tariffs and a bunch of other stuff, right? So I think that like that has been more unique to Trump himself, I think, than to their communications apparatus.
I do agree that the Republican Party made a deal with the devil a bit when Trump came in with their agreement to work with him, but I guess just when I look at Trump, I see an incredibly stupid person who probably didn't even understand the three branches of government, you know, let alone what anything in the government could do. I think it was painfully obvious in his first term, and it's coming out more and more the second term now as Bondi is gone, because they don't know how to do anything. Even when it comes to doing, you know, false charges against people, they can't even appoint prosecutors correctly for it. But despite that, despite how inept he is, you know, I think there's a website that tracks it. You know, I think like half of Project 2025 is implemented, which I think is pretty impressive given how much of a clusterfuck the current administration is. And the fact that like the Federalist Society can still recommend all of their judges and these guys will get appointed. And, you know, the Trump admin will go. There will be some kind of reshuffling of the Republican Party that will be beneficial to us at the very least, you know, in the upcoming midterms and in 2028. But a lot of their agenda, it feels pretty sticky. And I think that, you know, there is damage at the very least with the Supreme Court, that will be here for a while. Yeah.
The Supreme Court damage is huge, and it'll be interesting. I was literally talking to Bill Kristol about this morning, about why it's so important for the Democrats to win the Senate this fall, and this kind of ties to our other conversation about how do you win in red states if you're the Democrats, because the Democrats take control of the Senate, they can at least try to play the Republicans' game back against them on Supreme Court nominations, assuming Alito or Thomas ever leaves, and hold those up and try to get back the Merrick Garland seat that was stolen. But I think that they've been very effective at on the areas where there's alignment across the board. And the top one of that is tearing down the administrative state. Like the government, the Republicans do not want the federal government to work. They're not interested in it. The moderate side of the party doesn't want that. The Trump side of the party doesn't really want it. And the Elon, whatever you call it, the tech bro kind of group that got attached to the party, at least temporarily during 2024, they're not that interested in the government working. And so I do think that part of Project 2025 has been pretty effective. But it's like anything else, man. It's like easier to tear shit down than to build it up. Uh-huh. Like they haven't really... You know, if you look at Trump and they're like, well, what are the things, the proactive things that he has done that will be sticky? You know, it's hard to come up with stuff. I mean, like 2 months ago, you might have said the Abraham Accords. We'll see how that looks.
Sure.
I mean, I would say months ahead,
probably
right?
Long-term damage to a lot of the relationships we have with other countries is a given.
That's all
for sure.
Tearing down. A border, yeah. I guess border would be something.
Oh, yeah. Like, no, I'm thinking of all tearing down stuff. Like USAID, I don't know if that's coming back.
Yeah,
Department of Education.
So, no, they've been successful at that, no doubt. Mm-hmm. I just think that, like, part of that is because you know, that's grading on a curve. You know, it's just in anything, including in politics, it's easier to break something up than to do something. And so I think that partially explains why they've been a little bit more effective policy-wise than than, you know, recent Democratic administrations have been.
Although I will say, as a result of this, and we'll get more into this on the platforming part of this, I think as a result of these, like, media, the way that the media kind of has this back and forth between, like, the administration, the mainstream media, and the alternative media, it really makes it impossible for the Democrats to, like, positively sell anything. Like, there are questions that get asked a lot, you know, like, where is the Joe Rogan of the left? You know, why is it that as Republican popularity continues to drop, the Democratic popularity doesn't go up? Like, it's not a seesaw. They're just both falling. And then, you know, like, how is it that Trump is able to, you know, fluidly flow through so many different positions? I heard in the same, I don't know if you listened to what he was talking about today. I think I heard him say today, he used both the, we've been at war with Iran for 47 years and 25 years ago, they had a wonderful government. Like, it's like, he's just like, whatever. He can just say literally whatever he wants. And then I look over on the liberal side of things, and it's so funny because, you know, Republicans all the time accuse liberals of all being, you know, CNN and Washington Post and New York Times, fake news, corrupt news, all for the liberals. And man, you've got, like, months into the Trump admin, you've got Tapper releasing a book on Biden. You've got, you know, endless criticism for Biden and Kamala Harris. You know, even still, you've got the far left, you know, people who are all trying to devour Gavin Newsom because he hates trans people, because he said to Charlie Kirk that, you know, maybe the trans athlete thing was a dumb idea. It's like, it's a brutal world out there because you have absolutely zero alignment when it comes to center left stuff. And then, like, again, the primary frustration I brought up was that people analyze so much stuff downstream that I don't think they're giving credit for how much upstream is happening. Like, a common thing I would hear, and I've heard you and Sarah go over this, and a lot of people, they'll say things like, you know, in the future, we have to work better on messaging. And I agree with that to some extent. But when you hear somebody say something, like if somebody says, man, this president is not messaging very well, that is only ever being said by somebody on the left, because on the right, they know their job is to message. Hannity's not saying Trump is communicating this poorly. Hannity is communicating it for Trump.
For Trump,
And I'm not saying, like, the left needs to be all sycophants, but that synergy is, like, unstoppable, you know? Like,
I hear that. And part of that is structural from, like, we could just be honest here, that, like, the mainstream media was more sympathetic to the left than the right, right? It wasn't Fox. Like, if you just go back 20 years, right? If you, you know, CNN, ABC News, whatever, they weren't sycophantic in the way the Fox is, but the people that worked there tended to have more sympathies for the Democrats, and they tended to be more sympathetic to Democratic stuff, particularly on social issues, not on everything, right? On war stuff, they're kind of more sympathetic to Republicans oftentimes. So, you know, so anyway, what spawned out of that was Fox gets created, and Rush Limbaugh gets spawned out of that. And they are just talking point machines for the Republicans because they say we need this to bring balance, right? Because the mainstream media is so left. And we're still kind of living in the downstream of that, right? Where the Democrats now are trying to create some, you know, whatever, ethical monogamy, Fox and Rush Limbaugh things, right? But it's harder to do because a lot of the consumers of that stuff are still consuming the New York Times, still consuming Jake Tapper, still consuming mainstream, particularly in the older demographics, right? And so, and then people are like, well, is there as much of a market for this? You know, the market is, you know, the market's more competitive to do that on the left, right? Because, you know, Fox had this, like, half the country is like, we're just going to go propagandize to you and they'll all easily leave ABC, right? So some of this is structural. That's getting broken down a little bit now with independent media and social media, and you're seeing kind of various forms of that, but it's, we're in the early stages still. And I think that the Democrats have a huge way, or the left really has a long way to go to catch up. And meanwhile, while the Democrats are catching up, the Republicans are iterating on their advantage. And so I think, to me, this, going back to just the point from earlier, I think the number one thing that they have going for them, more so than, like, positive stuff about themselves, is being able to tear down the Democratic brand and having that efficient pipeline. Because in addition to all that stuff you've been talking about, they're able to add on top of that Manosphere World, Maha World, like a bunch of Streamer World, a bunch of other independent type stuff. And are those guys, are Aiden Ross and your random Maha, you know, CrossFit lady influencer and Theo Von, like, do they have any coherent positive ideology together? No, like they're all totally, some of them don't fuck anything, like some of them are morons and some of them are opposites literally on policy. But what do they agree on? They agree that the libtards are crazy, that they're, you know, whatever, that that's, you know, the woke stuff is stupid, that they don't want to wear masks, right? Like all this, like, negative polarization stuff. And so, and I think that, like, now the Democrats are still way behind, right? Like the left is now trying to catch up to having to balancing out the Fox pipeline problem. which they're starting to do, still behind, because as you mentioned, there's a lot of meta discourse still on the left criticizing the left. Mm-hmm. But now I think that it's almost like fighting the last battle. Like, I've been to a couple of these confabs, democracy confabs, where rich people, you know, ask what they need to fund. And I say the same thing at all of them. I'm like, stop funding echo chamber news sites. Like, that's fine. Like, that ecosystem is now building and growing, and it's going to keep growing on its own. Like, go fund stuff that's outside of news, right, to help communicate. And that's a major problem. And I agree with you. But I do think, though, just one last thing, one pushback to you on the communication thing. Mm-hmm. The Democrats have had uniquely horrible communications people at the top of their ticket for three straight cycles now, with Hillary and Biden and Harris. We can just be honest about this. Harris was maybe the best of the three, but none of them were A+. And I do think that some of this would be mitigated if there was a party leader who was at all adept at this. I agree with you. This pipeline problem would still exist, but you can't tell me that Obama would have lost the last election. You just can't. That he would have totally allowed all of tech world and all of the Mansfield world and all of the minority men to like spiral away from him to Donald Trump. Like, I refuse to believe that would have happened.
I think
it matters.
I think he would have lost. I think that the issue is, like you're saying, like, don't fund or boost echo chambers or whatever. I think something that's changed a lot over the past few years is this, the algorithmically generated feeds for people. Yep. You remember back when they switched, what was this? Like, I don't know, man, I don't know how long. I lost track of time after COVID. 5 or 6 years ago, when we had like chronological timelines, and then it switched over to, when people started doing that for news, I think you run into this weird world where, like, if I look at, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones, you know, Littlefinger says chaos is a ladder or whatever. If you
I know
have
the quote.
This, yeah.
I don't do anything in the magical forest. Sorry, okay. It's one of my cultural limitations.
Oh, okay. Okay, what a Star Wars kit? No, I'm just kidding. Whatever.
Not a Star Wars
kit. Okay, either. Whatever. I don't know what you media consume. Okay, you coastal elites, all right?
I'm a coastal elite. Totally. Yeah,
exactly.
You're doing prestige, watching prestige television.
Exactly. Okay, so if you have... oh man, you just ruined my...
Chaos is a ladder, sorry.
Sorry, you're good. When you have an environment where, if I look at the media environment, okay, and I see kind of the left is all doing this, you know, they're different competing ideas, and they're trying to be fair and honest, and they're trying to do their best to not have Trump derangement syndrome, and they don't want to be accused of being too partisan, and there's that mess there. And then on the Republican side, I have this perfectly beating heart that is just rock solid through and through, carrying literally whatever message they want. When it comes time for the algorithms to start picking up on anything, well, conservatives are telling me that 30 million illegal immigrants came in, that Laken Riley was raped and killed by illegals, that Biden is open borders, that Kamala is an idiot and unqualified. And then on the left, we've got, well, maybe we didn't open the borders, or maybe Biden was open borders, and maybe he did fail in immigration. And there's all this like hesitancy. Even if it's a more intellectually honest endeavor, the algorithms are always going to pick up on that surge of Republican synergy. And then when it comes time to consume media, well, I don't know if you've ever, if you know any people in real life or whatever that have fallen into this, I know people who are like decently intelligent. Once they start down that hole of altered reality, it's over. Like it's over. You can't do anything. When you talk to somebody and you say anything, you're basically like making this promise of like, I have a pig at home that can fly, I promise you. Like, that's how crazy it is to say anything. Like I'll argue to people, you know, like, how many things are said that are true that if you were to just take a step back and look at the record are objectively not true, right? Trump is a great deal maker. The biggest deal that he made, he destroyed his trade deal with Canada and Mexico, right? What else? What other deal maker? Why is he given that? Or that Republicans are good when it comes to the debt or the deficit? Like, where does that come from? Or, you know, no new wars, and we've got, let alone his first, you know, administration, how many different countries he bombed, Syria, Yemen, everybody else. Like, all of these things are able to be said, I think, not because Trump is particularly talented at communicating or because they have a good communication manager or whatever else, but because all the other Republicans know at the end of the day, all the people on Fox News, when they turn on the TV and they say Trump say the dumbest possible shit imaginable, they're immediately workshopping, all right, guys, how are we going to sell this one? What are we going to do to get everybody to believe in this shit? And I don't think that liberals can exist in that environment in a way that where you have to either destroy the way that those media ecosystems work, or unfortunately, you have to have your own like synergized, borderline sycophantic resonance of messaging.
Yeah, but,
I think, yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot of pushback on this.
Yeah,
because
go for it,
I agree with your... I agree with you, the challenge. Like, I agree with the frame. Like, the algorithm is totally fucked, and there's a huge portion of the country that is being fed sludge, and it's almost impossible to communicate to them. Like, this is a massive challenge.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of pushbacks. So, number one, sometimes it backfires having a sycophantic side. I think that the Biden thing, unfortunately, like, the left was too sycophantic around Biden, I think, towards the end. And I think that a lot of people weren't willing to hear reality about how he was being perceived outside of their liberal echo chamber bubble. And so I think there are risks to echo chamber. I think that the right-wing echo chamber is powerful, but I do think that Trump is unique, and I guess, and you're seeing this breaking down right now. And so I don't want to say that the challenge you laid out would not exist in the future. It would, but like, they are not in lockstep right now anymore. I mean, there's massive infighting happening on the right. You're seeing, you know, at least in the independent media and the influencer class, that's papered over a little bit on Fox, but not as many people are watching Fox anymore. I just think the ability to control the narrative, we might be watching that start to dissipate right now in real time. Again, I just on policy stuff, is everybody going to be in lockstep for Ron DeSantis or J.D. Vance or Marco? I'm a little bit skeptical of that. And then lastly, I will repeat my thing. You might be right that it's impossible to break through with communication with a talented politician. We will never know. But I do think that, in retrospect, I mean, the more talented communicator has won every election of me and your life, like, besides COVID.
Well, would you say between like Hillary and Trump? I feel like.
Yeah, who liked Hillary? I mean, Obama said was likable enough, and Hillary still won the popular vote. But
sure.
I don't know.
I agree with what you're saying, though. I agree with what you're saying, that she might not have been likable, but after a decade or more of conservative attacks, after hearing about how she owned Uranium One and sold all the, I think that was an intentional thing. Yeah, and if you listen, especially now, if you listen to Kamala and Trump, or if you listen to Hillary and Trump, like, Trump is funny for sure. But man, he sounds like an idiot. He has no idea.
What he's I voted for Hillary, and I was part of the great right-wing conspiracy against her. So I hear you. But sure. I think that's a judgment call if you want to make it. I think that Trump is clearly a little bit better of a communicator than she is. But look, I mean, it's Clinton, Clinton, Bush more than Gore, Bush more than Kerry, Obama, Trump and Hillary, Biden. It's during COVID, and Trump, you know, and then we have Kamala Trump. I do think that this stuff is potentially achievable with a front person. I wish that that's not kind of how politics worked in this country, but it just is.
I guess, like I said in the beginning, to a degree, this is going to be true. But do you play any instruments? Just curious.
Poorly.
If you improvise or whatever, like, if you're playing with a set of musicians that are really good, it'll make you sound way better.
I used to follow jam bands in college.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Can be a mediocre player with a good band and sound amazing. Or even when it comes to conversations or plays or whatever else, just having a good partner helps so much. In my mind, the quintessential, like, Republican media system is when every single time, and I know you say that we glaze the left a lot, but like every time, I remember when Hillary fainted once. If you said that was back when you were Republican, you guys had a field day with that for weeks.
Yeah.
Remember the cough drop that came out of her whatever, I don't know, in the glass? Yeah, of course, right? Yeah, I heard about this so much. I think of Biden when he tripped over the stairs a little bit going up Air Force One. This was a thing that was talked about endlessly. I remember Trump walking up the stairs, and we thought we were going to have a moment. It's like, oh my God, Trump tripped the exact same way. And then 30 seconds later, when Rubio is walking upstairs, he trips as a joke to like make light of it, and nobody talks about it. And this cover
for
everything.
All the critiques, though, of the left, you can't say that like there has not been enough unanimity or criticism of Trump. I mean...
Sure, criticism of Trump, but even like how you criticize Trump, like there are so many things that they managed to win the narrative on that like liberals will not bring up Russia anymore. Like how many times do you hear Russiagate? Hmm. The Mueller investigation turned out credible indictments. Manafort was convicted. Yeah, it's insane that you can't bring that up as a liberal anymore. You feel like you've got Trump derangement syndrome. The impeachments, like
it's not a problem in the bulwark. We can bring up Russia.
Yeah, 100%.
Still,
yeah, you guys are going to.
Yeah.
I hear you though. The fact
that
45-minute call exists with Giuliani, who wasn't even a member of the government, talking to the Zelensky, that's just crazy to me. The Jan 6 stuff is completely abandoned. Every every minor talking point that we were right on. I don't know if you remember, like, the Charlottesville, like, good people on both sides thing.
Oh, sure.
Trump
yeah,
was referring. Hoax. It was a Nazi church. And the fact that even Snopes says, well, you know, Trump wasn't actually referring to the Nazis. Like, those were the people who organized it. I feel like, yeah, we kind of hate Trump. But again, when they have so much unity on their end, one of the things that you mentioned before that they're able to pick problems out is, I point this out a lot, that when you're on the defense, the best thing that you can do is hold ground. That's the only thing you can do. You're never gaining ground. And Republicans get to fight on every single topic constantly. Like, we're having arguments on whether or not there are actually kitty litter boxes in schools for furry kids to use in the bathroom or whatever, right? And it sounds funny and it sounds goofy, but it's like, that's another day that we're not talking about the 500 impeachable things that Trump has done in the first year and a half. You know, and then as a final point, because also you say this, I worry about the normalization of things. We kind of said this in term one. When you say things like, there's a lot of infighting on the right now, like, yeah, kind of, but like, I feel like
micro
Trump
penis
done,
Mark and, you know, yeah, macro Clint like, Megan isn't enough for you?
That's, when
you
we say infighting, I feel like Trump has done like over a dozen impeachable things this term. And to say that, like, well, they're kind of second guessing it reminds me of when Kamala was running. Like, I wouldn't have been happy for Kamala to win all 7 swing states. In my mind, Trump is such a deplorable person. This should have been like a Reagan tier blowout. Anything less would be unbelievable to me. The guy tried to coup the government. But
I mean, I concur with that. I remember being sad the morning after Biden won because it was like I knew we weren't done with him because it wasn't nearly enough. So I hear you. Mm-hmm. I think it should have been a lot more too. I guess I'm trying to just separate out like the areas where I think that sometimes I just get frustrated with like learned helplessness.
For sure, I agree.
It's like, oh, you know, like the other side is just so good at this. What are we going to do? And it's like, well, I don't know, man. Go inside the other side and see how, you know, screwed up their processes. You'll find out that there's a lot of veepishness happening over there too. So mm-hmm. I hear that. My version of your critique of the left is like, I feel like that the left has conceded the argument on who governs better, kind of, even.
True.
And like Gavin Newsom is that's one thing I get. There are actually more than one. There are a handful of things I give Gavin credit for lately, but like he's really good at being like, wait a minute, you think California's terrible? Let me tell you about the stats in Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. You know what I mean? It's like, it is crazy that like it feels like the entire country has just accepted that California's been governed poorly, which it has. But somehow the fact that where I live, Louisiana, Tennessee, Mississippi, West Virginia, the fact that all of those states are being governed poorly, like, doesn't register for some reason. Mm-hmm. You know, and like, so I do think that there are, like, when I did the Jubilee, I specifically picked that as a category because I was like, I feel like it's my job to push this back into the narrative. It's like, by the way, Republicans are governing their states like shit when they run control everything. So I don't know, man. I hear that. I think that there are some limits in the architecture of how these things are communicated. And maybe this gets to the thing I'm going to talk about. And I do think, I do concur that the left, the powerful and loud left attacks on the party also contribute to that quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree with that. To the point of what you just said, I remember, I don't know if it was Milo Yiannopoulos or Owen Schroyer I was having a debate with, and they brought up the whole, you know, rents are out of control in California. And I posed that question to them. I was just like, why do you think the rent is so high there? And there's like no answer or no response, you know? And I was like, well, yeah, a lot of people want to live there. It's a massive state, right, with a lot of opportunities. Like, there's no other side that's ever given to. It just must be horrible and terrible in every conceivable way. And it's like, really? That's like, that's the end of the conversation. Everything's just expensive because California sucks. Okay, the socialists and the tanky people, those are point three. I just want to pit stop on point two real quick.
Oh, we got to do point two first. Okay,
yeah, real quick, okay? This is something that's so important and it drives me crazy. And I've spent so much time debating and arguing on the internet. I have a good understanding of all this stuff. And I think most people intuitively understand it, but so many words get mixed up. When you're having like conversations with people, I have this box. There's like four different types of conversations you can have. You can either have, like, I call it a same team conversation. So this is like Tulsi Gabbard going into Fox News. This is Sean Hannity interviewing anybody in the Republican Party. Going there and you're basically just yes-anding each other the entire time. You're asking layup PR questions. That's it. Okay?
Yep.
You have the friendly conversations platforming. So there might be like some disagreements, but you're here to exaggerate the similarities, downplay the disagreements, and to make both sides more palatable to each other. So this is like every single centristy podcast with all the comedian losers or whatever, right? So yep. So these are your two, like, you're supporting.
So
Theo
having
promoting
on J.D. Vance.
Exactly, yeah. You might get, like, one kind of, like one tough question, but like the person can answer however. There's never a follow up. There's never a push or anything, right? And then your two like more negative forms of conversations are, I call them adversarial conversations or hostile conversations. So adversarial is like, you know, these two people are here to debate. They disagree. They're trying to undermine each other, right? Now, it's not going to get personal or ugly or crazy, but like the goal, you're exaggerating your differences, and that's, you know, what the conversation is for. And then a hostile conversation, it's like, I compare this a lot to like the British interview style people. So if you saw Ben Shapiro, like on Andrew Neil.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
This is where you're going to get questions. There are going to be follow-ups, and you better answer well or they're going to grill you on them. Mehdi Hasan is good at this. Piers Morgan, when he's in his British interview mode, is good at this.
Yeah.
When people talk about like, should you platform Hasan or should you platform whatever person, people just use platform and then they start talking about these things and they mix things up. And it's very irritating to me. I've heard Rokana do this and other people do this where they'll say things like, I don't think this person should platform anybody. Or why are people saying you shouldn't platform? We'll say Hasan is the example, right? Yeah, sure. Nobody is saying that this person should never be platformed. It's, people are saying there shouldn't be a platforming in like an ultra friendly, ultra collaborative way where it seems like there's total uniformity of belief on both sides when there's not. Like, yeah. I think, I don't know if it was you guys brought up, like, or somebody else I was listening to brought up, like, if Josh Shapiro were to go on Hasan's platform and debate him, like, that would be, like, an interesting, like, an okay thing to see. It's when there's this, like, false unity thing that's here is, I think, what people have a big issue with, what I would have an issue with in other people. Yeah.
I don't feel seen by any of your four categories, so I want to kind of I want to try to come up with a fifth bulwarky Tim category, which is I guess kind of like number two, but where I try to do like friendly dickishness. I don't know. Like anytime I have a politician, I try to have like a mostly friendly conversation, but I pick two things where I want to be a dick with them about and lock in on those. So anyway, I think that's another alternative that is different from like an actual, you know, Piers Morgan or Mehdi type interview.
Can I ask for those people, are these like people that you want to roughly support or?
Yeah. It's like people, like when I interviewed Harris after the campaign, I was like, I started the conversation by being like, I wanted you to win so bad. Like I went, like this is a friendly conversation. I don't want to pretend like it's not a friendly conversation.
Yeah.
But I also have a couple of things that I think that you really screwed up and that what I think that we should go through over, right? You know what I mean? And so I don't know, maybe that is like Theo, but just not as stupid. I don't know. Maybe that's category two, but just not as dumbed down. But anyway.
I think on the description that I wrote here for friendly conversations is you show up with both audiences understanding that there is some disagreement between both sides with the goal of emphasizing similarities while potentially noting some disagreements between you, but the focus will be on building on the similarities between both sides. Focusing on how closely united you should be against a third party, basically.
Yeah, right. Most of my conversations kind of fit in that with, with varying degrees of friendliness, I guess. Friendly to mid-friendly.
But I imagine you probably wouldn't have that conversation if you guys had, like, Stephen Miller on.
Oh, of course not. Right? No. Yeah. Right, obviously not. Yeah, obviously not. Or really any Republican, frankly, at this point. Except for, like, the Phil Scott, governor of Vermont. So, on the platforming question. Mm-hmm. I also get really annoyed by this conversation. People ask me about this all the time. I guess my Olivia Nuzzi conversation is a good example of this. People are like, why did you platform her after she slept with RFK? And I was like, it was kind of in that category two-ish, but two to three, and she kind of cried. So it's like, couldn't have been that friendly. And I'm like, dude, these people are famous already, right? Like I feel like people have lost the plot on what the platforming like issue was supposed to be. Like the initial reason why this came into our discourse at all was because like random far right Nazis who had barely any reach were getting put onto platforms and getting more and more famous. And like obviously that I'm against that. Or like you shouldn't like make crazy people tankies or Nazis or anything. You shouldn't make them famous if they're not already famous. The conversation then is different if there's more famous people. Okay, so I wanted to start there. Now you have somebody that's actually famous. The other thing I object to is like going on to their platform is not platforming them. They already have a platform. The point of going on to their platform is to communicate with their audience, maybe to get a message across, maybe to hopefully nudge them your direction a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of Democrats would use the word platforming to be like going on a show of somebody who has bad views. Like, I think that's crazy. Like, we should be going on shows of people with bad views. That's how you try to break them out of the bubble. Maybe that's hopeless. Maybe you can only win over 1% of the people, but winning over 1% is better than zero, and so it's worthwhile. Uh-huh. So now that comes to, like, the only legitimate platforming discussion I would take, which is, what should I do on the Bulwark podcast? Like, should I have somebody on that has said offensive things and bigoted things? And I think that the answer to that is, like, only if they're going to be challenged directly. And so I guess that probably should have to be category 3 or maybe a harsh 2.
Yeah.
Harsh friendly. I'd be open to a harsh friendly, depending on how noxious they are, mm-hmm. somewhere between 2 and 3 of your categories. And I think that's a harder question. I think that, you know, I think it's different if you're an individual streamer versus I have, like, you know, we have a whole company. Like, I have other people, you know, I don't want other people to feel like their brand is sullied or their values are sullied by my choices, right? So some of those decisions make it more complicated for me.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, that's, I don't know, did that answer your question about how I see the platform and conversation?
Yeah, a little bit. I think you're intuitively at the correct place. I think most people are actually at that place, or they should be if they think about it. I do agree with you. And as somebody who's debated a lot of unsavory people, a lot of Nazi there's all these types of people, I'll get hit sometimes with that. Oh, why are you platforming this person? In my mind, even if there is a disproportionate amount of popularity, the adversarial and the hostile conversations should never really be making the other person more popular unless you're really not prepared for the convo. Like, when you're right. having challenging conversations, your goal is to undermine the other person. That's the goal. You're trying to make them or their ideology look bad because you have substantial disagreements. Right. And that fear to ever engage the other side in adversarial conversations is very, very, very annoying to me because especially now when they've gotten so prolific, you know, a lot of people don't even know how to have those conversations anymore. And you get these stupid comments, like you said, where somebody's like, oh, you can't platform X figure. And it's like, X figure, you know, just signed a, you know, $50 million Spotify deal, or they have one of the largest podcasts in the world. What do you mean you don't platform them, you know, for like a Candace Owens type person? Like, these people already have the platform. And then much to the same.
Yeah, I mean, if I were you, I probably wouldn't go on like a random Groiper, like a random tier 3 Groiper stream, because maybe if they get one over on you and they can clip it. Uh-huh. You know what I mean?
Potentially. Okay,
there are exceptions
to
all these things.
These
right?
are things yeah. that I factor in, yeah, for sure. Like, if somebody's like, I have a 100 subscriber YouTube channel and I want to debate you on like whether or not this African tribe has the warrior gene or something. It's right. like, I don't have the time to research all this in particular. I don't know if I would do that. Right. But one of the frustrating things is that people will say that, like, oh, well, you guys want to platform people now. Well, why were you guys so upset when Joe Rogan and everybody else was doing it before? They still do it. And the reason why people are upset, even if they can't phrase it correctly, the reason why I'm upset, and I know most people are upset, again, even if they can't phrase it, is because Joe Rogan, they pretend that they're having adversarial or hostile conversations, but they're really having, it's usually now like almost same team or at worst friendly conversations. There's never follow-ups. Yep. There's never fact-checking. I don't know if he took Jamie out back and shot him or what, but like, I never hear anymore. Like, is this actually true or whatever? And yeah, that type of platforming, it's only there to bolster the other side. It's there to like increase the popularity of the person that you're bringing on. And that is just,
totally.
Yeah.
And this is Tucker's the prime example of this right now. I ain't broken as those guys are, but I just think it's most acute with Tucker because he's so good at the category 4, at the adversarial conversation, right? Like, Tucker is as skilled as Mehdi probably at really undressing someone if he wants to. And it's just like, look at how Tucker treated Ted Cruz versus how he treated Putin or Fuentes.
Yeah.
Now, I'm no Ted Cruz fan, but like, you can, but your thesis here is brought out perfectly. Like, if Tucker had Fuentes on and treated him like Ted Cruz, some people would have complained, but that would have been an interesting conversation for me. I would have watched that. But having on people to glaze them, or to, you know, let them sing and wash themselves, or to whatever, like that I agree with that. That is a big problem. And I've said this, I keep bringing up Theo as my example, because as a Louisiana person, he's just the one that comes to mind in that category the most. At least mutual friends. I kept trying to send messages to him being like, just stop having people on that you're not capable of interviewing, right? Yeah. Like, I don't think you're a bad person. It's just like, you're only capable of doing interview 1 and 2. And so you shouldn't be interviewing people that are making life and death decisions, that are, you know, that are conspiracy theorists, right?
But
like,
then,
just keep on having on goofy people.
Like, I agree with you in principle. And if these people were principled, they would agree with you. But remember, the issue, I think, is that ecosystem from before is so powerful that so much is being pushed in such a convincing and synchronized manner from the Republican movement, that if everybody on America's soil is talking about how terrible, you know, Haitians eating cats and dogs or whatever lie, even if J.D. Vance says it's a lie, and now all the other podcasts are talking about it, you're like, oh God, everybody's seeing this pop up in their social media feed. I think I have to cover it. I need to bring these guys on to do it. Like, the incentive structure pushes them so heavily towards that audience capture perspective. And yeah, I agree with you. It's so annoying.
So how do you stop that? What's, you're the one that wanted to inject this idea into my brain. What do you do?
I just want people to be aware of it. You guys have to figure out how to stop it. I don't know. I don't have the reach that you guys do. But people get so caught up, like, they, because I just don't think they're analyzing. Like, we had that one moment, I don't know if you remember, for like a week where we were calling them like weird or whatever. And people were like, oh my God, this attack is working because of whatever. The reason why it worked is because it was simple. And that was like, it reverberated through the top and bottom of every part of our ecosystem. It just happened organically rather than Republicans to do it very inorganically. And that's why it was so effective, is because it was hitting them on all points. And they were like, oh, Jesus. Like, for the first time, Republicans were on the defense for like, you know, 4 days or whatever. But then, you know, the media cycle changes and they get back on their thing.
Yeah.
There are ways that you can counter this, but it involves a lot of deep conversations about like my ideas are all very right. Like, I think that if you're a politician, like if you're a lawmaker or a member of the cabinet or the president, I think you should be under oath when you're speaking on interviews. I know it's crazy, but I think it can't be that Trump, or it can't be that they're just allowed to fucking lie. That Kristi Noem can say Renee Good was a domestic terrorist and there's no account. That's just insane to me. That's just a crazy world to be in. Or like,
it's an interesting theory.
Or making
really, I'm a free speech person, but I'm for like really just tough algorithm rules. And I think if the Democrats get back and they have to be really much more aggressive with the tech companies. I was reading the Ronan Farrow. I have Ronan Farrow on the podcast tomorrow to talk about his Sam Altman profile. And it's like, you think all this stuff is bad now? Like, we're 2 minutes away from them to be from them being able to execute this pipeline of misinformation without even having humans involved.
Yeah.
And fucking and OpenAI, the guys that started it, now Sam is like now Trump's travel buddy and his butt buddy, and Greg Brockman, who's running the company, like donated, you know, $25 million to MAGA Inc. and another $50 million to only pro AI candidates. It's insane.
It's
and like
unbelievable.
And they need to be made into full on enemies, in my opinion.
100%. And the projection, because remember, the Republicans said that because the FBI was making suggestions to Twitter about accounts that it thought were like compromised Chinese bots or whatever, that meant that the FBI was in control of all of our social media.
Right.
But when the richest man on the planet buys X to become a partisan, takes over the America account to make a pact for Trump, becomes a partisan supporter of the president while owning that platform singularly, when Mark Zuckerberg is going on Joe Rogan to talk about how actually the Biden admin treated me unfairly, and I do actually think that Trump is better on free speech, after Trump threatened him on Truth Social to send him to prison forever, right? He was making these crazy truths. The fact that, it's so crazy on the other side how much they're pushing these social medias, you know, in this direction under threat of locking people up and stuff. And then on top of all of the, you know, I feel like the admin spends more time going onto podcasts and doing the podcast circuits than anything else. My third point. Rounding it out here. So, okay, there's a couple of things. First, I'm going to say this, okay? I'm in the online world. I'm sure you've had people email you a billion things or reply under your comments. I know Sarah's getting them now about the unsavory things that I've said and done, whatever. Okay, there are edgy things, okay? But then there are ideological disagreements. And I know in your guys' world where you have some level of, I don't know if I would say media training, but there's like, you guys have minimum thresholds of behavior that don't exist here in my world, okay? Yeah. In the online world, okay? But I know that it seems counterintuitive, but if somebody has a horrible ideology, but they're labeled by other people as being incredibly edgy, that is a huge boost to their ability to communicate with people. And I see this mistake made. You guys just published another article, or the Bulwark did, about Hassan, I think this morning. And this fixation on like, Hassan says edgy things. He said this thing about Crenshaw. He said this edgy thing about America deserves a 9/11. I think that it's a mistake when the fixation is on just edgy stuff, because I think that you can overlook edgy comments. I would say this is somebody that makes edgy comments, right? But what I would wish that people would do is fixate more like, okay, forget the edgy comment, okay? What is the underlying ideology? And when you look at a lot of these types, Hassan for sure, but like the socialist movement, I think in the far, far left in general in the United States, these people are not ideologically aligned with the Democratic Party. And they've basically said, not basically, they have said as much multiple times. And there's like superficial kind of layover sometimes, but like when you actually try to cash it out into some kind of policy, it's never there. You know, like I've seen people on the far left, Cenk will attack the Affordable Care Act because he says that it's part of the, they call it a corporate release valve all the time. Or you've got people on the far left will play into IDPOL or social issues until those are brought up in opposition to some socialist idea. And then, you know, I've seen, there are videos of Assange screaming about it, like social policy doesn't matter. It's totally irrelevant. This is just rainbow capitalism. They're just throwing things in front of you to try to distract you from the class issues. And then, basically what I'm trying to say is that, like, yeah, it's not just that they're a little bit further left, it's that there's like a substantial ideological disagreement where their goal is to destroy the Democratic Party literally and to co-opt it and be subversive while trying to get people on the left to appeal to them.
Right. I have a lot of thoughts on
go
this.
For it.
And so we'll just, and I would like, I want to make sure that, you know, the full the full view of them is shared. So if you need to go a little long, whatever, I'm around. I got bumped from my Nicole Wallace hit on MS Now speaking to the to the boomer libs.
What a rebrand, MS Now.
Okay. I think there are a couple of things at play here in the discourse around Hassan or the tankies or socialists or whatever on the left, and I just want to kind of disaggregate. Part of it, like what you're doing, like you have an ongoing, running, like almost kind of global college dorm room fight happening with Hassan, like over a decade, right? Which is you're trying to convince people the values of liberalism, he's trying to convince people the values of democratic socialism or left-wing authoritarianism, whatever he landing. Yeah, he would call it the former, but it might really be the latter. And I think that's an important debate to have, and obviously I'm on your side for that, right? You know, maybe not on every specific sub-issue, but like as far as the trajectory is concerned, and I've criticized this on a bunch over the past couple of months, including in person when the one time I met him. And so, like, I think that we can, like, that's one thing, and we can talk about that. Uh-huh. The other thing is the question of, like, how the left interacts with partisan politics, okay? And in particular, I'm focused right now on how the anti-war left intersects with partisan politics more so than, like, the socialist left, because in some ways they overlap and in some ways they don't. And I think that the Democratic Party has really hurt its brand over the past decade by letting Trump take the mantle of being the anti-war person. And obviously that was bullshit. Obviously you and I saw through that. Some of the far left streamers did not see through that. We should dunk on them and call them stupid in the world of streaming, right? That is fine. But, like, that doesn't change the fact that it happened. Like, it happened, you know, and there's a significant chunk of the population. Some of them left. Some of them are consuming Manosphere podcasts. Some of them are not really political, that just aren't a fan of wars, think it's stupid how much money we've been spending in the Middle East, don't want themselves or their kid to go to war. And, like, the fact that Trump said that was appealing to them, and the Democrats, like, seemed like the party of whatever, the blob. And I think that that was a branding mistake in retrospect, like, obviously. And right now, in this moment, in April of 2026, like, is the Democrats' best chance to, like, recapture that they are the party against stupid wars. Right? And it doesn't mean that they're isolationist or whatever, but, like, we are the party against stupid wars. It was Bush that sent us to Iraq and Afghanistan. It's Trump that started this Iran war. If you are paying more at the pump right now, it is because of Trump and because of his friends in the Middle East, MBS and BB, and the other corrupt buddies that he's doing deals with. Like, it's their fault. We're on the other side. If you put us back in charge, we're not going to do this. They tricked you. You were fooled. I'm sorry. We're doing my best to win you back over. Like, I just think that it's, like, really important that the Democrats recapture this posture right now. Mm-hmm. And so, like, for me, the Hassan discourse got wrapped up in that, where I was like, I just thought it was really stupid strategically, like, whether you're putting on your Democratic Party hat or your centrist hat or your liberal democracy hat, to be like, right now, I'm going to pick the fight with the anti-war left. Now, if you're more precise about what you're criticizing Hassan on, okay, but, like, this, I'm trying to you know, all of this stuff, you know, letting, you know, the Jewish Insider blog in D.C., which is a Republican cutout, like, dominate the discourse. And, like, you know, by asking John Ossoff a questionnaire about what he thinks about Hassan, like, this is fucking stupid. Like, I got into this discourse by posting on Twitter, Democrats should tell any interest group that wants to know their opinion on Hassan to eat shit, right? Because the only groups that are trying to do it right now are trying to do it to run cover for, you know, the people that are in favor of this war. And so, anyway, so, like, that was the beginning of this, and then it spirals into a bunch of other stuff. And so I have more thoughts on how Democrats should engage with the left, but, like, those are my two main things I just wanted to make clear at the start.
Sure. So on the second thing, I 1,000,000,000% agree. I'm going to look back to my earlier kind of media model for why I think, unfortunately, like I hate the anti-Semitic attacks against Hassan. I do actually think that him and a lot of people on the left, him especially, are anti-Semitic. But I care about social stuff, but I think there's way, way, way more problematic things than anti-Semitism, especially because Israel is fucking it all up anyway. So my sympathies are very low at the moment. But the issues are these, like deep...
Israel is fucking it all up. Yeah. I should say that Hassan has definitely said some anti-Semitic stuff, including as recently, mm-hmm. or as recently as like last week. But he also, I think, is feeling the pressure on this. And this goes to like a third point I want to get to eventually, which is like he's modulated his rhetoric on that in a way that's potentially useful. But anyway, you might think it's potentially unuseful. But
definitely it's all dog whistles, but not even like quiet dog whistles. Like when you're screaming at somebody, calling them a baying pig and all the inbred comments or whatever about Jews and everything else, like these are they're usually hitting on certain anti-Semitic tropes. Like they need to go back to Brooklyn. They don't belong there, stuff like this. But regardless of that, I think the reason why the Jew discourse carries is because the Jews have, you know, as has been noticed through the last 2,000 years or whatever of human history, they're very good at doing their media messaging, right? You've got your AIPAC people, you've got your, I don't know if the Southern Poverty Law Center or the name of the, no, it's not them. There's another group that is on Twitter that like calls out like anti-Semitic people or whatever. Like they're
the
very
ADL.
Yeah, ADL, the ADL, that's what I'm thinking of, yeah. They're very good at their vertical integration and everything. They label somebody, you know, like this guy's anti-Semitic, here's why, and then that message like resonates within the entire tuning fork of kind of the, I guess like Jewish interest structure or whatever. I'm trying not to sound too much like an a** right now, okay, but this is a little bad. But like they're very good at like messaging on these types of issues.
You're not I'm trying very hard to not go on platforms.
You're good.
I've not watched all 8 hours of your streams every day.
I promise I'm not an okay. Yeah, okay. Of course, I was an I would say exactly that, right? No, I'm just kidding. I'm not. But they're very good at messaging on this thing in a very unified way, which I think is why this is what's carrying through the strongest. But the other type of messaging, like I agree and I scream, okay, and I agree so much that Democrats aren't good.
Sorry.
Unbelievable.
That is such an amateur move.
No,
right
you're
there.
Good.
Oh
it
my
happens.
God.
That's a streamer right. mistake. So you're coming to our world, okay? It happens, you know.
Keep going.
That the reason why the Democrats can't stake out a position on this is because right now the anti-war rhetoric, I think, is completely captured by that right-wing tuning fork and your far-left tuning fork. And to stake out like a decently nuanced position on the center-left would require our resonating tuning fork to where, my God, there are so many criticisms that you could give of Israel. There are so many criticisms you could give of American foreign policy, you know, in general, but there is no democratic apparatus to message any of those criticisms through. So like, I don't know if you've ever been in an area where, you know, coming from gaming, girls say dumb stuff online in the streamer world, but when you criticize a woman in the gaming world, you got to be really careful because it's 90% men or whatever, there's a lot of sexist stuff. So I have to be careful because I know if I start attacking somebody on a thing, like there's going to be 400 Twitter mentions like, oh, this girl streamer said a thing that this is really dumb. And a whole bunch of people come be like, yeah, this stupid, this dumb, why shouting? It's like, okay, well, hold on, Jesus, not like that. Calm down, Jesus, guys. Yeah, and I think with the anti-war messaging, it's an issue that has been so captured by both sides. It feels really uncomfortable to step in and be like, yeah, you're right. I think we should be anti-helping Israel in the war. And they're like, that's great. So we're going to abolish the state tomorrow, right?
Right,
and then,
yeah. You have a lot of people brigading on you that do say anti-Semitic stuff. This is my thing on the anti-Semitism discourse. I've talked about anti-Semitism a lot on the podcast. I'm genuinely concerned about it.
Yeah.
I also think that that like this war and the way that they've argued for it is doing more to propagate anti-Semitism than almost anything. Like I there's almost no acceptance of that among the people that are like big Israel supporters, and because they refuse to accept that. And I'm like, I'm sorry, like conflating criticizing Israel right now when they have at some level been involved in encouraging us into this war. I'm not trying to say that it was like they did it, so we wouldn't have ever done it without them, but like they were a big part of getting us in this war, and they're our partner in this war, and it's the stupidest war imaginable. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a total disaster. It might empower Iran in the end, and people are paying more. Everyone's lives are going to be made worse. Nobody understands why we're doing it. And so it's like, I don't think it's irrational for a regular person who wakes up one day and looks at the price of their gas tank and it went up $20, and they're like, why is this happening? I haven't been following the news. Why is this happening again? And then people are like, well, Iran had some nuclear missile. They had some ballistic missiles, and they had too many ships, and Trump decided he wanted to bomb them. Yeah. And it's like, and then another person says, "Oh no, we did it for Israel." And it's like, I don't know, man. I'm just sorry. One argument just seems pretty compelling because the people who are making the case for this war have not made a very compelling case for why it is, and it's going to cause a lot of harm. So I just think that, like, I'm frustrated. Like, that is frustrating in this moment. That, like. That is the position that we're in, but that is just the position that we're in. And so I think that the Democrats, I think for good instincts, for the reasons you just laid out, don't want to be as loud and clear-eyed as they could be on this because they're worried about that. Like, they're worried about having, and it's just like, man, this is the thing. Successful, there's only two parties in the country. Like, if you become the president, you had anti-Semites that voted for you, you had homophobes that voted for you, you had bigots that voted for you. It's just like, if you get 70 million votes, like, that's just the nature of it, right? And so, I'm not saying that Democrats should say or do anything anti-Semitic, but they need to be 100 times more passionate in opposing this war that's going to fuck up people's lives than they need to be in fighting internal internecine fights right now. And you as a streamer have a different obligation and job than a Democratic politician. Mm-hmm. And you're on here for 8 hours. So you can fight as many internecine fights as you want. But, like, I just feel like the Democratic establishment needs to, like, get the credibility of being anti this war as clearly and passionately as possible. I'll help them with the echo chamber. Midas will help them with the echo chamber. MS, I don't know. I think there are plenty of people out there that would help elevate really passionate anti-war voices right now on the Democratic Party. And, you know, a couple of them are doing okay. Ruben Gallego's doing pretty good. Chris Murphy. But it's missing right now. Think of the 2028ers. If you thought about the potential 2028ers, who has been, like, the most vocal and clear and passionate in opposing this war right now? I can't think of anybody. It's hard to think about who would be the fit for that. And I think that's a huge mistake.
I do agree with you that we need that more positive position out there of somebody saying it. I think there's two things here. So one is, my issue is just, you can stake that position out without trying to appeal to or I guess like curry favor with people on the, I would say, on the far left, whose positions, sure, you know, might be superficially similar, but they're not, you know? Like, if you had a friend that came into your house and your other friend is like, that guy's going to rob from you, and you're like, what do you mean? It's like, he's black. All black people steal. It's like, okay, whatever. If he does end up robbing you, I don't think you would say, oh man, like, you had a really good point, actually. Racism is actually really good. Damn, I should just assume, right? And, you know, if you look at all these people on the far left, they were calling it a genocide and apartheid or whatever on October 8th, right? Or before. Right. Like, these people have been saying this forever. And you know, you said before, you know, a ton of different people vote for you and, you know, you don't have control over who's voting for you. True. But there's a big difference between, like, 20,000 homophobes voted for me versus, like, I'm trying to appeal to homophobic people, you know? So I agree, and then going to the second point is, I'm hitting on that media resonating thing I said before. Yeah. I definitely agree that the Democrats need to have a stronger position that they stake out on it. But my God, like, when you're a Republican, you can walk out on stage. I don't know if Trump ever wakes up sometimes. He's like, I'm just going to do this for fun. I'm going to say some crazy shit and see how they defend it. And everybody will defend it. From, oh my God, who was it? It wasn't Pam Bondi. Who was that? What big Republican figure was that? Oh, it was Megyn. I think Megyn Kelly was talking about how banging 14-year-olds might not be a big deal. It was I'm like, Jesus, what are we talking about here?
Femophilia.
Yeah, oh my God. Yeah, they were right wheeling now, out the libertarian pedophile arguments. I'm like, Jesus. Meanwhile, if you're on the left, whoo, dude, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz had a tougher interview with, I think it was CNN, than I've ever seen Trump have in his life on any platform ever. And if you're on the left, man, yeah, I'm seeing, like, the New York Times is writing pieces calling Gavin Newsom homophobic. And it's like, how can you stake any position anywhere in this media environment when the whole right is going to come down to you? Yeah,
everybody on the far left. Even, like, the mainstream outlets that are supposedly more sympathetic end up having to, like, go overboard to prove
how not TDS they are.
Right, yeah. And so, I think that's a real challenge. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about this one thing, because the Hassan thing ends up making it very much about Hassan. And I think that actually the Zohran case study is more telling. Mm-hmm. Zohran, if I had lived in New York City, I kept saying on some podcasts, I would have ranked him last, but I just wouldn't have ranked Cuomo. Like, so it would have ostensibly been a vote for him in the end because Cuomo was so bad, but like I would have been for any of the other random people that were running for mayor. He came on my show. He gave the worst answer he gave on any question the entire campaign on my show about globalized intifada.
And
that ended up dogging him. So I was not like glazing him in any way, but we did platform him.
He
so
did
I,
walk back he was running on, for that, mayor. On that supporting that quote, though, which was good.
He did end up walking back, right.
Yeah.
So this is where I'm going with this.
Mm-hmm.
Hasn't And we engage with them a bunch on the topic of like quote unquote abundance related stuff. It's not just me, so other people did as well about like, you know, cutting red tape, making New York City run better, like typical, you know, whatever, either technocratic left or classical liberal right type stuff. And, you know, we're in month three, but he posts anytime that there's a hate crime against Jewish people, he posts about it. On social media, he is, and there's crimes happening every day in New York City. So he, you know, he would have reason, he couldn't, didn't have to, but he does. He posts about anti-Semitic crimes all the time.
Uh-huh.
He is cutting red tape. He's backed off some of his craziest views on stuff. He kept the New York City police chief in charge. Like, isn't Zohran an example of like the big coalition working? Like, he took from some of the centrist stuff. He tamped down some of his lefty stuff. The lefties really are still excited about him, mostly, except for, like, the really crazy ones online, you know? Mm-hmm. But your average lefty is. A lot of the centrists that weren't excited with him have kind of been like, okay, he's fine, I guess, you know? Isn't that an example of how the model works? What's wrong with that? What's bad about that? I mean, he wouldn't, you know, he's not from here, so he can't run for president. He wouldn't be my pick if he ran for president. But like, I don't know. I think that at the Bulwark, us engaging with him ended up being a net plus.
Yeah. So here are these are like two big things. One is the biggest thing. This is like the no brainer thing. Okay. Have you heard the saying that like the left purity tests and the right doesn't? You've heard people say this. You might have said this.
Sure. Of course. Yeah. Right? Of course. Yeah.
This is the least true thing in the universe. Okay. The right. Absolutely purity test you, but they purity test you on your support for the candidate. I always bring up these two examples. Kyle Rittenhouse floated voting for a libertarian candidate for like 6 hours because of the bump stock ban from Trump. And that guy was wrapped back into the fold like that night. And then I don't know if you remember, but Joe Rogan on his podcast was floating the idea of supporting RFK, I think, as an independent candidate. And within like a day, he walked that back. He's like, well, no, I think I would support Trump. They're very big on purity testing on the support for the candidate. And then outside that, they don't give a fuck what you do. As long as you're supporting the Republican candidate, they're fine. On the left, they purity test over things that aren't related to like electoral power or politics, which is why it seems like there's more on the left, because no matter what you do, you can't get these people to vote for you. So the big thing that I look for on my first point is like, do you support the party and the candidate that wins the primary?
Yeah.
One of the big things that Zohran said, there was a whole series of elections. It was like 14 of them, and we won every single one like a year ago. I wish I remember I just know there were a ton of them. There were a lot of moderate candidates that ran in these races, and I think a couple maybe progressive ones. What Zohran said was that different candidates are appropriate for different races in the country, and we should embrace all of that. And I think that is the exact correct idea when you acknowledge that, like Zohran is probably significantly to the left of me. I think he's done a great job in New York City so far. He's messaging a ton. His media team is amazing at everything they do. But I appreciate that Zohran is not spending his time in a plus 40 blue area attacking purple Dems constantly, you know?
Right.
And that, yeah. But then when I look at like, I can bring it to Hassan, but like.
Though Zohran didn't do the reverse, didn't happen for him. I mean, Hakeem never endorsed him. It took forever. Schumer
sure.
took forever.
I mean, it's a New York City mayor race. I don't know how often. I don't think historically they tend to have that
much. Given the nature of that race, the establishment Dems should have just been for him. But fair.
I don't disagree with you.
It goes both ways.
Yeah. Especially given that populism is having its moment and all that.
Yeah.
But, when you go through and you look at how, like, the Majority Report, how Kyle Kalinske, how Crystal Ball and Breaking Points, the Young Turks, Hassan, when you look at their treatment of, like, the Democratic Party, oh, my God,
it's brutal.
Brutal. One of the examples that you brought up earlier was, you know, when I talked about my buckets of conversations, one of the biggest disasters is when you go on and think you're going to have one convo and you have another. And you actually brought up an example that I listed, which was Ted Cruz going on Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
He thought
Alyssa Slotkin going on Breaking Points.
Exactly.
Is that where you're going
to
go?
Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, these Dems for the first time are like, I'm going to try to have this conversation, but they don't understand where the media environment is. Same thing with Ted Cruz. Either Tucker Carlson was on Fox, I guess, so he must be cool. Meanwhile, Tucker Cruz just came back from Moscow showing how amazing it is that they have bread in their grocery stores. I'm like, Jesus Christ. Yeah, but those, like, they're so openly hostile. And when you have people who weren't even supporting Kamala for president, like, I'm sorry, but regardless of your political beliefs, this was the easiest GED level question of like support Kamala or Trump. Even if you cared about Israel and Gaza as a single issue, Kamala would have been dramatically better. Biden was dramatically better than Trump on the Gaza issue. You know, Iran attacked Israel. We didn't go to war with Iran when Biden was president. The inability to support the candidate, we've played this game over and over and over again where they don't get their Bernie Sanders, they don't get their ultra-progressive candidate, and then they're like, oh, whatever. Or it'll be like the weakest, the most tepid kind of, you know, well, I don't think you should vote for Trump, but I'm not going to tell you who to vote for kind of thing. That's unacceptable in my eyes. Yeah. And when you're courting those people and you're trying to make overtures to those people, I think you're trying to court, one, a base that you'll never truly gather because the extremism they want is so far away from what you could do. And then two, in trying to court those voters, you're going to have to move to such extreme positions, you're going to lose more. And all the polling, at least that I've seen, is that Democrats generally want people who are more moderate in views. Yeah.
Well, and this is why, and again, this comes back to why this little kerfuffle in the discourse about Hassan right now was why I was so adamant about how dumb it is to fight. Like, the third way types are fighting them on their strongest turf, the far left, like that crew, right? Like, honestly, I mean, what the Democrat, and this is my frustration with those guys on the left, is like, since Kamala lost and Hillary lost, anytime in the discourse now, it's like, well, we can't run any centrists anymore because they don't know how to win. And it's like, what have you guys won? Like, you guys haven't won anything. Like, you haven't won a single swing state once. Like, yeah, try to win something somewhere that's not a blue state, and then I'll listen. What I think, my personal opinion, nobody has ever tried this. Dan Osborne is kind of trying it in Nebraska right now, in a little bit of an imperfect way. What I really think makes sense for Democrats is to move to the left on foreign policy, because that's where the country is. Move to the left on some economic stuff, probably more left than I would like on healthcare or whatever, but I can read polls. And then cut to the right on cultural stuff. Right, like most people in Nebraska are against the war, want health care, but also like cops and aren't into woke speak about campus stuff, and you know, also don't, you know, want a reasonable immigration policy. Like, that would be a great compilation of issues. And my frustration with the left is that never happens. Right, they're all, you know, it's always, it has to be, you know, if you're one inch to their center, you're an enemy. And that part is crazy, and I think that is why I was saying that was kind of encouraging about Zohran, that he ended up not being like that. He's ended up being much more pragmatic than his most annoying fans, and I think that's good. And I think that if we could encourage there to be other lefty candidates to do stuff like that, I think that would be a net plus. Maybe that's wishful thinking, I don't know, but I think that engagement is worthwhile on that point. But also, like, you know, calling them out when they're doing stuff that is damaging is also good. I think not just in the way that we were talking about, circling back to the original conversation, not about how the left concedes to MAGA a lot. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't think the central left should concede to the far left on electability. And you are seeing some of that out there. And,
for sure.
And so, but a part of the way to do that is to win and show you know how to win and to be pragmatic and practical as well. And I just think that, like, fighting them on foreign policy in the middle of the Iran war, fighting them on Israel right now in the middle of this war is insane behavior. Bye.
Yeah. I don't necessarily disagree, although I will say that the way that they operate is identical to the right in that the grounds that you're fighting on are almost always going to be dictated by them. Like, if you listen to any of these people have been talking about and obsessively talking about Israel-Palestine for years, and it is the only thing they talk about. You can show up to any of these platforms to debate or argue, you mentioned with Slotkin, right? It's going to get dragged back to Israel-Palestine. And then the answers that they're wanting from you
Just give them the W on that and then move on and then try to move on to other stuff. Well, try to move them on other stuff.
Because the only W they would take would be like, you're in favor of like the abolition of the state of Israel.
Israel, right.
Yeah. Which is like, it's so far and you're just so out there. Yeah, which is why I think it's important to have an like a generally less war position. I mean, I say anti-war, I guess, but I think we should support Ukraine,
for instance.
War.
Yeah,
anti-stupid war, for sure.
But it can't.
But
war.
If you're perceived as immediately capitulating to these people on the far left, it becomes very easy for people on the far right to kind of attack you. One thing that I think people don't realize, and the far right is so good at this, the far right is very cognizant that people on the far left do not represent a threat to them at all. And you can tell because they always use the far left to attack like moderate left Democrats, but they don't just attack, but when they're attacking moderate left Democrats, they try to destroy them, right? So like Jimmy Kimmel and everybody, you know, it was like the FCC, get this show taken off the air. But nobody is like bringing all this pressure onto like these very far left people to like deplatform them, you know? Like they like the fact that they exist there because they can always use them as a useful cudgel to attack other Democrats with. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm checking myself on this because it's always like, you don't want to fight the last war. And I don't, you know, maybe I have too much PTSD from being in there. But like, I lived this battle on the other side already, right? Sure. Like losing the fight from the far right to the moderates within the Republican Party. And part of the, you know, among the mistakes that were made were, number one, not believing that the far right could actually win ever. And that was just a huge mistake from the center right and the center left. You know, just strategically speaking, like empowering Trump was like a literal strategy of the Hillary campaign as well as the moderate Republican campaigns in 2016, because they thought that, okay, well, he could never win in the end. And here we go. So I think that just not falling for that. I hear you. The far left is not as popular as the MAGA right is, but, you know, just not making that same mistake, I think, would be smart. And secondly, just I think that we made a mistake on the center right being like not ever wanting to hand it to the, you know, could we have gained credibility with the base by saying, yeah, the Iraq war, we fucked it up. Like, we fucked it up. We shouldn't have been spending so much money on these foreign wars. We should have spent more money at home. You know, yeah, the border got out of control. I don't know. Like, there were various things like the populist right was upset about, and the establishment on the right refused to engage with them on. And so, like, they overthrew the establishment, kind of. You know, so anyway, yeah. So I think that, like, those two things, like, both kind of hang in my head when I think about this, the framework of this thing, too.
I definitely agree. Like, there are times when you can't be obstinate on every change, especially when the winds are blowing in a certain direction. But I think, harking back again to that media model, I think it's very important to keep in mind, like, what are real issues versus what are fake issues. I trigger the fuck out of everybody when I say certain things, but, like I stand by this. Like, illegal immigration, that was a fake issue. That was just not a real thing. And my evidence of that, and I argue with every single conservative on this, my evidence of that was, if you cared about illegal immigrants at the border, there was a huge bill, right? Lankford Senate, from the Senate, there was a huge bill to close the border, and Donald Trump, not a conspiracy, right? You saw him say it, Ted Cruz already said, Donald Trump said, kill that bill, I want to get into office. Donald Trump comes into office, first he said 15 million illegal immigrants, then it went to 20, 25, now 30 million illegals came in under Biden, and they haven't really done anything to deport these 30 million people. I think 2 million was their largest estimate. Now everybody fucking has ICE, and I guess he shut down the border, but like, how are you telling me that you cared so much about immigration, illegal immigration, but now nobody talks about it anymore, except for when Trump is sending ICE agents around assassinating American citizens, and then you've got you know, apparently there are still 28 million illegals here, but Republicans just don't seem to care about it as much anymore. This is what I mean when I say, like, I don't believe this is a real issue. This is a manufactured issue that Republicans put in front of you. You can have strong feelings about it, but much like there weren't drag queens that were indoctrinating 20% of Americans' children, there weren't Haitians actually eating cats and dogs. And J.D. Vance admitted in that interview, yeah, you know, if I got to make an issue up to get you to care about it, he said it. It was crazy. And yeah, that. So I think when you're fighting against some things, I think you have to be very careful not to capitulate to issues where I think you should say, like, yes, we acknowledge Americans have strong feelings about immigration. This is why we're trying to do this on the border or whatever. But the Republicans can't get to control the frame, because what happens is you have these problems that aren't real, meaning you can never fix them because nothing you do is going to be enough. And then when they come into office, they don't even have to do anything to fix them. Mexico never built a wall. Like, none of this stuff ever even happened. I had a guy telling me he was so happy about how ICE and the Department of Homeland Security and everything was working like 2 days ago when I was at UCLA. And they just fired Christine Nome. How could you possibly be happy with that? What are you talking about? It's not a reality game, right? They make up issues, they put it in front of you, and then you get really mad about it. How are you supposed to fix the issue?
I know. We're too rational. I do agree with that. We're too rational. I always have felt like that was a weakness for me as a boss as well. Maybe it's a weakness as a content creator. You know, the good bosses demand irrational things of their underlings.
Sure, yeah.
But I hear that. I hear it. I don't know. I don't know how to fix that.
The media thing, though, when you control so much, you can push any message you want. Again, I'm not saying we should do it, but at the very least, we have to disrupt the other side to do it. Otherwise, they can just push anything they want, and it's insane to me. This is my last thing to bring up, to be cognizant of, okay? Because I see Sarah's going through it right now on Twitter. The way that MAGA argues, and the way that these like far left people argue, and you can always see the way they do it, is whenever there's like a disagreement or a big issue, you can never actually have an argument on the substance of any of these topics ever. It will always be, you ignore the subject matter, you pivot to something different, maybe something you can morally grandstand on, you attack your opponent by misrepresenting them or ascribing to them some other crazy belief they might not even be related, and then you just repeat this over and over and over and over and over again. And that is the only way that these people engage. And the reason why they can do it is when you go back to those conversation buckets I listed earlier, all of these people only cycle through the same team conversations or the friendly PR conversations. Everybody does it on MAGA. There are no real like debate people, and everybody does it on the far left. So when Hassan is fighting somebody, you'll see all the usual suspects, pop up. Like Ryan Grimm is going to be there supporting him. Emma Vigilant is going to be there supporting him. All the maybe Breonna Joy Gray, depending. All of these people will come out and they'll defend any position possible as long as they're on the same team. And remember, I just think the message that sends, like if I'm getting these people in my algorithm, they're so right on everything. That's the world I live in. They're able to castigate these other people as adversaries and evil Nazis and everything else. And yeah, it's so hard to break through that. But like, I think it's important to be cognizant of the way these people
control
fight.
The narrative. No, I'm cognizant of it. And I this is true for every group. But like, I think just picking battles is very important in this world.
For sure.
I think that's informs my perspective on this one. Yeah, no, Sarah's definitely in the barrel right now.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. I know you can never, I've been there. And one thing that you can never tell somebody that is in the barrel is that they should stop because they're having the fight in their head and so sometimes you just got to let it burn out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I'm sure if you've been through it, you always tell people, like, just wait like 4 days and it'll be so much better, I promise. But yeah, a person's first journey through internet hell is always the toughest to go through because they're like, it's over, bro. It's like,
been there, man. I've been in fetal position before. So, I think I got it now, though. We'll see.
Okay, cool. Anything else you want to...
Dude, I appreciate this. It's been overdue. And we can just keep in touch. You know, give me tips, pointers on my streaming journey.
Yeah, good luck with your... With your streaming, right. Load up your PS5 and your NBA 9K or whatever you guys are playing now. Yeah.
I feel a little bit intimidated that you have. I saw online that you have Frank Fukuyama after me later today. So you're elevating the intellectual game a little bit.
Yeah, something like that. Here. Yeah. Actually, no. We're gonna go over the videos of Hassan shocking his dog for about an hour and a half. I really want his perspective on the type of shock collar I think he was using. So.
All right, bro. I appreciate it. Holler at me anytime. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Good luck.
All right, we'll see you.
Bye.